behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bolin.
Ben, we've got a topic today that I think a lot of our listeners are going to be pretty happy that we're finally getting around to recording.
Yeah, I'm happy we're finally getting around to recording it, too.
I have to admit that I am, too.
Because this is a topic that you and I started working on in three weeks ago, maybe?
It seems like a long, long time ago. And I've got a pile of notes here that have just done nothing but grow over the past 2 or 3 weeks. So there may be a lot of paper shuffling on my side here, as there always is, really. But I've been adding post-it notes and post-it notes to those post-it notes for a couple of weeks. And the big reason was because we've had a major weather event here in Atlanta, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard of.
Right.
Big ice storm.
Mm-hmm. We are recording this on the Friday of the January ice storm week. So as you might know, if you have been around a television or a radio, Atlanta was hit with an unexpected dusting of snow. Not that much snow, actually, 2 inches maybe, but the way that it was handled in the city made traffic dangerous.
Yeah, the big problem was ice, and you know what? I think that's almost a podcast in itself and what happened and some of the aftermath of that, because the images that the rest of the world got to see from here in Atlanta during this week.
Yeah.
Pretty remarkable. I mean, deserted streets with nothing but abandoned vehicles. It looked like, you know, people wandering aimlessly around trying to find the cars.
Post-apocalyptic.
It really was. It was a really strange scene. So, maybe we can even talk about that someday.
Yeah, but Scott, you and I and our super producer, Noel, are all hale and hearty, and everyone we work with is fine. Our IT guy, the indisputable master of all things computer-related here, Izzy, was unfortunately stuck in his car for 18 hours.
18-hour commute. That's amazing.
That's not his normal commute either.
No, but it's at least a couple hours or whatever. But honestly, 18 hours, that was kind of the norm in the early part of this week. So let's move on past this. We'll get to this because I really do think that's an interesting topic we can get to, you know, like road prep and how cities prepare for storms, things like that.
Because that's the key. And all of this to say that despite the obstacles, despite the scheduling, despite the little bumps in the road that reared their heads, Scott, this is an episode that you and I wanted to do so much that we've stuck with it for weeks. So we finally get to record the story of Preston Tucker.
Yeah, that's right. And, a lot of people are probably familiar with the film, the 1988 film. It's a Lucas film called Tucker, The Man in His Dream.
Mm-hmm.
And it was directed by Francis Ford Coppola, starred Jeff Bridges. Who else? Lloyd Bridges, a bunch of other people.
Martin Landau's in it.
Yeah, there's some big names in this one. But again, it's from 1988. And if you want, I can give you a quick summary of the film and just kind of tell you what it's about. And then I promise we're going to talk about the man himself and the vehicle and everything. We're going to get to all that. But the film itself, I mean, it really kind of outlines the main focus of where we're getting to in this story here. So we're going to get to this eventually. But basically, after World War II, Preston Tucker decided to build what he called the best car in the world.
The car of tomorrow.
Exactly. And this is just kind of a quick summary that I grabbed from Jalopnik. So it's like maybe 6 or 7 lines, but it'll get us through it quickly. Through connections and some pretty savvy and a lot of people think questionable salesmanship.
Right.
He ended up raising millions and millions of dollars. I mean, we're talking like $15 to $18 million, in the 1940s. To buy an old Dodge factory in Chicago, and he's set to work on this dream car. And Detroit afterwards kind of gets really nervous because they realize, like, well, this guy's really doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the word starts to leak out that, you know, Preston Tucker is really – he's up to something, and something's really going to happen here. It's not just some, you know, fly-by-night operation in a garage somewhere. This guy's got the biggest factory in the world really operating, and he's starting to turn out cars. So this real powerful senator from Michigan. The guy's name is Ferguson, Senator Ferguson, whose wife, by the way, owned lots of Chrysler stock, had it out for Preston Tucker from the beginning because, you know, they don't want him to succeed because it will make their stock plummet. And, you know, it's just competition. It would cost literally billions of dollars for them to keep up at this point. Billions, Ben, in 1940.
Right.
So, or late 1940s, I should say. You know, they get the SEC involved, and this is where the questionable part of the story comes in. Like, is this a setup? Is this something like a government takedown of this guy?
Yeah.
Well, it actually ends up being a government takedown, but is it a conspiracy is more the angle here.
Mm-hmm.
But the SEC and the U.S. attorney relentlessly hound Tucker until they eventually indict the company, and all of its executives for fraud because of the way they raise money for this whole thing to operate.
Yeah, for stock fraud, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And also the way that they questionably raise money. We'll talk about that later in the podcast because there's some interesting things that Preston did along the way to get, $2 million at a time, $3 million here, $4 million mm-hmm. there. So interesting ways he raised money. But later, now after the damage had already been done, later, everyone accused at the Tucker Corporation was found to be totally innocent of the damage, of the charges rather. But the damage had already been done. The press had already leaked all this stuff out. The name had been slandered.
Right. Yeah. And as we know, there are some accusations that do irreparable damage as soon as those accusations are issued. So if you're accused of widespread fraud and you're just trying to get your business off the ground, then that mark is going to remain because, as we always note in these sort of situations, the outrageous accusations will be in the headlines, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. In big, bold letters.
And 2 weeks later, the correction will be in the very back of the living section, maybe 13B or something.
Sure, yeah. It's going to be page 6, small print mm-hmm. in the back. Here's a correction to this. Oh, by the way, they're not guilty.
Yeah, and it'll be right there next to the guy selling a couch.
exactly.
But this film, which you and I have watched, is, first off, it's a good film.
It really is.
And secondly, it makes you think if you're not a Tuckaroo, or it's one of the names that I've heard people refer to as.
Really?
Yeah, fans of Tucker.
Hmm.
I didn't make it up.
I've never heard that.
But if you are a fan of Preston Tucker, or if you were just having a casual interest in this topic, then your immediate question is going to be, how close does this film come to the truth?
Hmm. Well, it does come close to the truth. I mean, they take some liberties with it, of course.
Sure. Yeah.
And, we'll talk about some of the differences between real life and what really happened when we get to the automobile production part of this podcast, because we are going to get there. That's kind of the tail end of this whole thing.
Right.
Now, but what they don't cover is the early years, because Preston Tucker, he was born in 1903, and everything in the movie, really, I mean, and I'm just guessing here because I haven't seen it for a while, but I think it begins in the mid-1940s.
Yeah, it doesn't get his early time. Scott, this is interesting. Did you find this one? Do you know where he was born in Michigan?
Where he was born. You know what? I do, but where is it? Go ahead.
It's a peppermint farm.
Yeah, a peppermint farm in Capac, Michigan. So he's got these really, really humble beginnings, right? I mean, it's not anything spectacular. It's not like it was, some major industry. I mean, we haven't heard of all the peppermint farms up in Capac recently or anything. So it's not like,
right.
This was, he wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Or
like
anything
a peppermint
like that.
Tycoon.
Yeah. And his father passed away when he was just 2 years old. So mm-hmm. he was essentially raised by his mother on a peppermint farm in Capac, Michigan.
Yep.
And grew up in that family home. And I think eventually you're going to find out that his workshop was like the shed behind his mother's home. And that's where this whole passion of the automobile, I guess, began for him. I mean, we've got kind of a quick story about him here if you want to hear it real quick.
Yeah, let's talk it out.
Now, he learned to drive when he was 11. So that's pretty early.
And by 13, he quit school.
Yeah, by 13, he quit school. That's right. So early on, all this stuff is going on early on. And I think it's mainly out of necessity. I mean, if you're driving at age 11 and you live on a peppermint farm, I'm guessing that, that's out of necessity. You learn how to drive on tractors and then you quickly step up to driving the work trucks around the farm, the cars into town to get whatever you need. And people really didn't say much about it at the time.
Yeah. Even today, a lot of states have, some age restrictions or some bending of the federal curve on age restrictions so that kids can drive earlier to help out on the farm.
Yeah, but not 11, I wouldn't think.
Now, no, not
now,
11.
Now, I was probably learning to drive. I spent summers on a farm in Indiana, and I probably was learning to drive around 11 or 12, but not actually driving. Now, I think he was actually driving, going out and getting things. But he was born again in 1903. So by age 11, he was what year was that? That would be 1914. Mm-hmm. Now, that is just 2 years after he had seen his first automobile. He hadn't even seen a car until 1912, which I found kind of remarkable. I found this little quick little story about him. that he was so excited when he was age 9 in 1912. He saw his first automobile.
Uh-huh.
Super excited about this thing. And somehow, Ben, I don't know how this whole thing works out, but through the excitement of this this meeting or seeing this car the first time, he ends up laying down with his legs underneath the car. The car runs over his legs. And he's on a muddy, dirty road, I guess, and it was so soft below him that the car passed over his legs harmlessly, which is remarkable. No damage done at all, but
wow.
From that point on, he had this passion. And you would think that, you know, the first time you see a car, if you're enthralled with it, that's
right.
One thing. If it runs over you, you would think that you might have some kind of aversion to them, right?
Well, he also, now this was a Buick, right, that ran over?
I couldn't tell you what the make of the car
okay,
was.
Okay, because I've heard this story in a couple places, and sometimes I've heard that it ran over his legs entirely, or just his feet, but that he was unharmed. And the nice little part of this that gets tacked on to the legend is that he later saved the Buick's gas cap.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. I have no way of knowing if that's true.
Well, you know what? A guy like this, after we learn about him what we do learn, I would almost believe anything that you hear about the guy now, because the more and more I read about him, the more and more we turned up. I mean, we found out so many interesting things. And a couple places that I'd like to steer people too, before we really get into some of this biography information, is a couple of really interesting film clips that I found of Preston Tucker
okay,
online.
Great.
And if you go to go to YouTube and search Tucker, the man in the car, there's a 12 minute piece, and it's in two parts. So part one is about 6 minutes, part two is about 6 minutes. So it's easy to watch this thing at any time. There's some really wonderful color film and narration that goes along with this thing. It's a promotional film that was created by the Tucker Corporation for the Tucker automobile. You know, eventually they wanted to get the news out about this thing. So a 12-minute piece, and there's, again, color film. That's really remarkable for that
right.
era.
Yeah.
And it shows a lot of Preston Tucker. It shows a lot of interaction with him and the vehicles. It'll give you a pretty good history. Now, remember, it's a promotional film, so it's going to be very pro-Tucker, very, over the top, I guess, in the narration. It's a little bit silly in the way that it's done, but it's very 1940s, and I don't know. It's got a good feel to it. You know,
yeah, and if you just like old commercials, you'll enjoy this.
Yeah, there's
kind of stuff.
The scratchy film, and there's a scratchy audio that goes along with it. I love that. It sounds like it's an old record playing, really. And then there's another one, a longer one that's called the Tucker Documentary, and that has a little bit more. It's actually the same stuff, but only black and white, which I thought was kind of strange. But maybe a better story because it interviews some people that worked for him back then that are still around today. And his kid. His kid is interviewed and telling about his dad and, you know, all the stuff that goes along with this. So those are a couple of really good sources for info if you guys want to go and look at that.
Yes, because we are betting that you, like us, will fall down the rabbit hole, ladies and gentlemen. We have to continue, though. I have to ask you, Scott. I have to ask you this.
What's that?
What is an office boy? Is it just like a gopher?
I think it's a runner. It's a page. You know, it's somebody that does anything. Like, I need a cup of coffee from the cafeteria.
Sure.
Take this memo down to the fourth floor.
Okay.
You know, I need this sign. Bring it back right away. You know, that type of thing.
Okay.
So yeah, he's what, out of school early on, right?
Right. 13 and he gets his first job as an office boy for Cadillac for a dollar a day.
Cadillac Motor Company. Not a bad gig, really.
I mean, that's great.
Pretty good. A dollar a day sounds a little bit chintzy, but again, you know, what year is this? I mean, that's 1915 or something like that. 1916.
Yeah.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Not bad. And especially for a kid. I mean, a young kid, he's probably making a lot more money doing that than he was on the peppermint farm. So, you know, as a child anyways. So, okay. So he's asked to work at, or he's, you know, procures this job as an office boy at Cadillac Motor Company, and he felt that he wasn't really doing his job efficiently enough. So what did he do? He's an innovator, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so he decides to ask his boss for roller skates, and he says, I think I can do my job more quickly. I can get around a little faster around this big office building here if I had some roller skates. And the guy kind of, you know, gave him a sideways look but said, well, I'll give it a shot. And he did it, and it really worked out. I mean, I think he was probably a very efficient office boy for a while.
Yeah. And he progressed up the ladder, but he worked for different companies as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we know that he was, you know, he started out as an office boy. He moved up doing some mechanical work, and he worked for Ford and Pierce Arrow and Chrysler and a couple other big names. And then he got to be, all along the way, he became a test driver. And then
I think we're kind of glossing over a few things though, because there's some interesting points that I want to make about what he had done early in his life, just after Cadillac.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, and this comes into play over and over again in his history. So this is kind of important. At age 19, Preston joins the Lincoln Park Police Department in 1922. So 1922, you got a picture of the time, you know, the type of vehicles he would be driving. And he joins not because he wants to enforce the law,
mm-hmm.
but it's mainly because he wants to drive the fast, high performance cars and motorcycles that the police own.
Which is so interesting.
It really is. And it's so Preston Tucker when you think about it, you know, when you look back at his life, because, you know, at 19, he knew early on what he wanted to do. He wasn't necessarily interested in law, just wanted to drive these fast cars and motorcycles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Lincoln Park is not far from Detroit. It's just south of Detroit. I-75 runs right through it. It's south of Dearborn. It's right in that area. So it's kind of a, I don't want to say a suburb, but it's a city within the city of Detroit, the metropolitan area.
Okay. Yeah.
I think back then it was probably a lot more rural at the time. You know, it's a little more wide open. But he was definitely interested in driving these high performance cars that the police had.
And he was what, 17?
19. 19 years old at that point in 1922. So he, the funny thing is his mom really didn't like him doing this.
Right.
So his
yeah.
mother, this must have been so embarrassing for him.
Yeah.
His mother requested to have him removed from the police force because, you know, she knew he was too young to serve.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was also giving them a little bit of trouble because he had actually taken a blowtorch to one of the vehicles. And this is kind of a legend, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I know this one.
What is it?
So it gets pretty cold in Michigan. You know that.
Yeah.
And Preston Tucker was never a patient man. So that's a huge problem that a lot of inventors have. So one night, so the legend goes, he was irritated because it was cold as Siberia, and the police cars, as fast and as well performing as they might be, didn't have heaters.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, I'm going to fix this. And his idea of fixing it was to use a blowtorch to cut a hole in the car's firewall and then take the engine heat escaping as a way to stay warm.
Sure, he ducted it right into the cabin.
And it worked.
It did work, but I don't think the police take too kindly to you chopping up your cars, you know, the cars with a torch.
You know, they didn't call it an invention. They called it damaging the car.
It's funny. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny how things are kind of skewed, I guess. I mean, because it seems like they could say like, well, man, if this really works, maybe we should do this to all our cars. But, there's probably the problem with, the summertime. I guess you could block it off in the summer, but, I thought it was pretty inventive.
I thought it was inventive too, but also, you know, if you're putting yourself in law enforcement's stance at that time, you got a subordinate who's already a loose cannon. Now he's cutting up cars. What's next?
Sure.
That's what I would say.
You're writing, your butt's writing checks that your body can't, well, have that.
Yeah,
steering,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
Anyways, you know the slang.
That your body can't catch.
Something like that. Yeah. Anyway,
your mouth's writing checks.
Your mouth's writing checks. That's it. That your butt can't cash. Anyway, so his mother gets him removed from the force in, like 1922, 23, something like that.
Right.
He's still young, too young to serve really. But he had everybody fooled. So his mom gets him kicked out, which has probably made him a little bit angry. But later in 1923, at age of 20, so just a year later, he married his first and his only wife, really. Her name was Vera. So in 1923, he was married, and the two of them operated a gas station together in Lincoln Park, Michigan. And the way that this would work would be Vera would work at the station during the day when Preston was at work on the Ford Motor Company assembly line. So he worked for Henry Ford early on, because he's right there in Dearborn. He's right there in Lincoln Park area. And he's working for actually the man himself, for Henry Ford.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure he saw him around the factory. It had to work out that way.
Well, you know, there's another story about that, too.
What's that?
We should just call this podcast Preston Tucker Stories, because Henry Ford apparently took a liking to Tucker for a time, because Tucker would be kind of a smart aleck and stand up to him. And we have to realize at this point in Henry Ford's history, he is, he's the kind of guy that people just gravitate around and say yes to.
He was the wealthiest man in the world, I think, at that point, wasn't he? Or at least
was it the world?
Maybe
the U.S.
Okay, maybe the U.S., but he was in the top three or five or something crazy that. He was a very wealthy, very powerful man at the time.
Point being that Henry Ford took a liking to Tucker because Tucker would stand up to him.
Yeah.
And
Well, he liked his spirit.
He liked his spirit. He liked his heart. Now, I don't want to go too far into that because it might bring up some other things that we were going to talk about a little later in the show. But what I will bring up is this.
And back to our story. How about that?
That sounds great.
All right. So I mentioned, you know, that he jumps around quite a bit. And it's a, I don't know, I guess it's a thing that he does. He's successful. I mean, at the end of his life, we'll find out that, you know, he'd really accomplished quite a bit.
Right.
But early on, he had moved around a lot. And I think that's a trait we find with a lot of successful people is that they try a lot of different things, right?
Yeah.
Well, he quits Ford, you know, who he had just been buddying up with. Mm. He quits Ford and he goes right back to the police force. So he still had that desire to be, you know, and on the, I don't know, I guess on the edge of, you know, driving the fastest, latest, greatest type cars, you know, the high performance vehicles that the police had. He just, he was intrigued by it. He was drawn to it.
Now, I think that's a great point because looking back, we can kind of tell. I'm going to go ahead and say it, Scott. I think Preston Tucker may have been a bit of an adrenaline junkie.
I think maybe he was. You know, I'm sure he was. This is his second time back at the police department. You know, he had joined. Been forced to quit, I guess, by his maybe not his mother requesting that he had been off. Went to work for Ford. Went back to the police department, and he began to sell at the same time as he's on the police force. He begins to sell Studebakers on the side. Now, remember, this is when Studebakers are new,
right.
So he's selling these on the side, possibly used at the time. And that's how he met this guy named Mitchell Doolian. And Mitchell Doolian, as you'll find out, is later credited as kind of being a partner of Preston Tucker's because. Much later, we'll find out that this guy, who is he's a well-known automobile salesman in the Detroit area at the time when Preston meets him as a Studebaker car salesman on the side. We'll find out that Mitchell Doolian eventually becomes the sales manager for the Tucker Car Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the two of them, you know, kind of stay intertwined, I guess, for the rest of Tucker's life, really. So Doolian hires Preston to sell cars for him. So, you know, Preston has to leave the force again, you know, the police force once again.
Right. Yeah.
So he's now selling cars full time. And apparently he did very, very well at this. And they found out that Preston was immediately successful as a car salesman, as a used car salesman.
Yep.
Or maybe even a new car salesman at this point. And the dealership has kind of this, like this long distance commute for Preston to make, you know, between where Mitchell Doolian's dealership is and where Preston lives at the time.
Yeah, the Doolian dealership, I know Doolian was based out of Memphis, right? Tennessee?
Later on.
Now,
that would be a long commute from Detroit to Memphis.
But it was initially a
Detroit, dealership. And Doolian does move to, you're correct, Ben, he does move to Memphis in just a minute, I'll tell you. But Tucker had to quit and go back to the police force for the one last time. You know, cause he said the commute was just killing him. It wasn't able to, cause, you know, along the way, he's having kids with his new wife, Vera. Tucker eventually has five children. So he's got a big family growing. You know, he's got a big house that he's, you know, trying to take care of and, you know, trying to provide for them. And, you know, it's just too difficult to make it there and back every day. So he joins the police force one last time. So this is, again, third time on the police force, the Lincoln Park Police Force. And, but Doolian still decides that he wants Tucker to sell for him. And he convinces Tucker to move down to Memphis, Tennessee, like you just mentioned.
Yep.
Because Doolian had moved south and he wants him to work as a sales manager at his brand new car lot. So shortly after that, Doolian was transferred, you know, cause of course, you know, Preston has just moved his whole family and everything down to Memphis.
Right.
And the reason that he's there to work with this Doolian guy, well, sort of the reason he's there, because, you know, these two are intertwined, I guess.
Right.
He gets transferred once again, but Tucker decides that he's going to stay in Memphis, Tennessee and work, you know, continue to work as sales manager on this Stutz and Chrysler vehicle lot, I guess. So he's selling Stutz and Chryslers, which are kind of funny now when you think about, you know, selling Stutz vehicles.
But, right. Yeah.
So that's what he did. And through that Stutz and Chrysler dealership, Tucker makes a connection with a company called Pierce Arrow Automobiles. And you'll find Pierce Arrow Automobiles at, you know, concours events and things now.
Right.
They were fantastic automobiles, like the type that coach builders would get a hold of and make these really amazing, incredible vehicles. And he ends up moving to Buffalo, New York to become a regional sales manager for Pierce Arrow. Mm-hmm. So he's getting all this experience, all this automotive experience, without really building cars yet, as we always think of Preston Tucker as doing.
Right. And going on what you said earlier, just 2 years, later, from once he's a regional manager for Pierce Arrow. Mm-hmm. 2 years later, he's back in Detroit, and he's selling Dodge autos.
Yeah, I know, for a place called Cass Motors in Detroit. And so he's moving all over the place. I mean, his family had to have been kind of getting a little bit tired of this, I would think, at this point. You know, moving here and there and back and forth, and his job hopping, I guess, at this point, even though I hate to use that term, job hopping, but I think that's what he's doing. You know, every year or so, he's moving on to something completely different.
Right.
It's like he's not satisfied with what he's doing. He wants to get better and better at one thing. Maybe not one thing, Ben, now that I think about it. He's probably just trying to find the thing that he really likes.
Right. And you can understand how it is if you're one of these sorts of people, or you know someone with an entrepreneurial spirit. It's often difficult early on to figure out where you want to put all your metaphorical eggs. You know, so often the world's great innovators start their early life like a compass, sort of trying to find north.
Yeah, and he keeps coming back to two key things. He keeps coming back to law enforcement.
Yep.
And he keeps coming back to auto sales. Mm-hmm. And apparently, I mean, we'll find this over and over and over again. Preston must have the gift of gab. He seems to be like the silver-tongued salesman, you know, that can sell anything to anybody. You know, everybody will describe him as the best salesman they've ever met in their whole life. I mean, he's very convincing. Mm-hmm. He can get you to buy anything. And that's just the way he is. He's just he's that kind of charismatic character. And a lot of people along the way will mention that as we go through this. Now, mm-hmm. We're back to where he's in Detroit. And he's selling Dodge vehicles.
Yes. And his family maybe is getting tired of moving through job to city. And so he says, I understand where you're coming from. I'm paraphrasing, Scott.
Sure.
It's like, I understand where you're coming from, but have you heard about Indianapolis?
Yeah, and this comes after a few different years of him making a yearly pilgrimage. In the month of May, he would go down to the Indianapolis 500 track and spend the entire month of May there. And, you know, all the qualifying, all of the gasoline alley activities that go on, he's fascinated with it. He spends the entire month of May, you know, right around the early 1930s, late 1920s, I guess.
Yeah.
Just kind of being around the track and being around the people that are there and making everything happen. And, you know, he's fascinated with race cars and race car designers and everything that makes them, you know, makes them work. And along the way, he meets a guy named Henry Miller. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Harry Miller.
Harry A. Miller.
Harry Miller. And Harry is I'll tell you about Harry in just a second, but Tucker is so enthralled with Harry Miller and what he does that he actually moves his family to Indianapolis to be part of this whole thing.
Right. And his cover story for this, now we'll use the phrase cover story, is that a Packard agency opened in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, I'd love to work for Packard. They're great cars, et cetera. Don't get me wrong, you guys, but clearly what he wanted to do is just live closer to the Indianapolis track.
And when he first gets there, what he ends up doing is he becomes a beer distributor's transportation manager. So, you know, he's working, you know, keeping the trucks on the road that distribute beer in the Indianapolis area, or, you know, somewhere around the central Indiana area. And it's not working at Packard that he's doing, you know, when he gets there. So his family's probably thinking, what's going on with this? But, you know, his real interest is working with Harry Miller. And Harry Miller, and I'll just tell you who he is briefly.
Sure.
Harry Miller was an American race car designer and builder, and he was probably, I think he's most active in the 1920s and 1930s. Very, very successful builder of race cars. Now, out of the cars that were built by Miller, that have won the Indianapolis 500, it's happened something like 9 times. So in that era, and I'm going to say some other numbers too, because I saw winners in 11 out of 16 races listed somewhere else. So, you know, 11 out of 16, that's a pretty good record. Mm-hmm. But other cars also had Miller engines, and those cars also won as well. So, you know, he was part of Indianapolis victories many times, if not more than a dozen times, definitely more than a dozen times. And you'll find that, you know, if you go back and look at the record books, you'll find that he's a very prolific builder and tester as well, you know, and he's trusted, rather, because Miller's cars or engines or whatever accounted for 83% of the entire Indianapolis 500 fields between 1923 and 1928. So in that 5-year span or 6-year span,
mm-hmm.
or is that 7 years, 6 years,
six.
83% of the cars on the track during the race were somehow related to Miller and his company and his engines or his entirely built automobiles, you know, like his race cars.
And Tucker sees this guy and said, you know, around, was around mid 1930s?
Yeah, 1935.
They team up and, they start a little company called Miller and Tucker Incorporated. And here's where another one of our characters in the supporting cast returns, because Miller and Tucker Incorporated, Scott, they had a contract to build 10 V8s for Henry Ford.
Yeah, well, for Henry Ford Corporation, for
Ford
Motor Company, which was now, I mean, just now being run by Edsel Ford.
Right.
So it's an Edsel tie-in. Henry's still in the picture, I think, at that point in 1935. I can't remember when
you're
Henry
right,
died.
Though. It's more Edsel is who they would be dealing with.
Yeah, but they're building hot rod Fords for the factory, which is really cool. That's the first job that they've got, and it's 10 Indianapolis race cars that they're scheduled to build, right?
Yeah.
And the problem with this, Ben, was that there was just not enough time for testing and development. I think there were some delays in getting, you know, all the testing equipment to them and all the machinery to put these things together. So the initial cars were extremely unsuccessful. It was kind of a flop. And this is really, I guess I want to say a tragedy, but not really tragedy. It's just that, you know, it didn't work out so well for the business. I think this could have been really, really great for them had they had the lead up time to the race, you know, to do the proper testing.
Yeah, but it turns out to be one of the biggest failures of Tucker's life thus far.
And it stands out in Indianapolis history as one of these kind of like, I guess a flop really.
Yeah.
Because, what happened was in the 1935 race, the steering box was located too close to the exhaust manifold, I believe. And the steering box overheated in every single one of these cars. And one by one, all 10 of those cars dropped out of the race because of steering problems. And this was just a huge failure for them. Of course, Ford, you know, they were upset with them, of course. But later, you know, the designers had worked to perfect that design, and all of those cars eventually made their way back to the track, and a lot of them raced all the way through the 1948 Indianapolis race. So you're talking about what is that? That's 13 more years that some of these cars ran and were successful in the race.
Right.
It's just that initial year, that initial launch of those vehicles was a failure. And, of course, again, that's the year that counted. That's when, you know, all the bad press happened.
Right.
And, by 1939, you know, of course, you know, these cars are back on the track and doing well. And, you know, he's still working with Harry Miller and Tucker. You know, there are cars in the Indianapolis, museum that say, you know, Tucker Miller on them. You know, the Tucker's name is boldly placed on these vehicles. And by 1939, so just before 1940, Tucker is really well known, you know, through his IndyCar involvement throughout the automotive industry. You know, the big guys know him. You know, General Motors knows him. Ford knows him. Chrysler knows him. They know who Preston Tucker is as early on as 1939. And that becomes very, very important in our story later.
Ah, yes, sir. That becomes, one might say, instrumental, but no spoilers yet. Another thing happens around this time. And that thing is World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And during World War II, as we know, the entire manufacturing industry of the world changed, right?
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Okay, so it's 1937, right? Let's go back there around that time.
Mm-hmm.
People know that there is a conflict on the horizon, right?
Yeah, it's looming.
And Tucker also knows a couple of things. He wants to build cars. He still has a love of law enforcement, as we had spoken of earlier. So who better to try to build some vehicles for than Uncle Sam?
Yeah, that's right. And he thinks that he's got the key to this whole thing. You know, he knows that war is coming in Europe. We're not quite sure that, you know, the United States is going to be involved yet. It's kind of iffy at this point because it's, you know, the late 30s. But Tucker knew that what's going to be needed is a high-speed combat vehicle. And he's got this idea it's pretty revolutionary, really. I mean, the idea of this whole combat car thing, that he designs. Now, he's working for the Dutch government at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's got a contract with them. He says, I can build you this vehicle. And he shows him the specs for this whole thing. We'll talk about it in a second. But the Dutch government is initially the one who's interested in this vehicle because they have muddy terrain. It's going to be very, very rough. It's going to be, you know, very rugged terrain. They're trying to protect the dikes that surround Holland, and if those were to be compromised, there would be, you know, there'd be chaos. It'd be mass flooding. There would be all kinds of issues that would go along with this, right? So they're trying to protect those. And one thing that he needs to develop, he thinks, is a high-speed vehicle that, that's able to, you know, deal with this type of terrain, this muddy terrain.
Right. So, but it also needs to have an offensive capacity. Mm-hmm. So, and it needs to be able to defend itself from other fire. So it's got to be armored and it's got to be fast and it's got to have a gun or firearms of some sort on there. And, he ends up making what we now call the Tucker Tiger.
Yeah, that's right. And he moved his family back to Ypsilanti, Michigan, to do this.
I mean, do they even unpack at this point?
I know. So he moves to this little tiny town, Ypsilanti, Michigan, and he's working on this combat car and, you know, the shed out back, I guess, again. Like, that's what he usually does, or a barn, I think, on his property.
Yeah.
The barn is where he does a lot of his work, I guess. But it has to have a couple of things. The Tucker Tiger that you mentioned, Ben, he calls it the Tucker Tiger. It has to be compact. It has to be, you know, a narrow wheelbase vehicle.
Right.
It has to be an armored combat car so that, you know, it can sustain fire. It can, you know, receive hostile fire, I guess, maybe.
Sure.
Bulletproof glass, that type of thing. And
yep.
The glass I saw was being removed and replaced. So that's an easy thing for someone to do even from inside the vehicle if, you know, the vision is compromised through that. Because, you know, when it's struck, it shatters. Doesn't penetrate it, but it shatters, and you can replace it from inside. It's an easy thing, easy swap out. Very thick armor all the way around this whole thing. It's all-wheel drive, very, very fast. That was one of the things that...
115 mph, I think?
Yeah, 100. Yeah, and apparently too fast for the U.S. military, as we'll find out. But it had a Packard V12 engine.
Uh-huh.
Air conditioning for the people that are inside it driving the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, let's see what else. It also had the biggest design feature on this thing, I guess, would be the turret, right?
Right. Which is why in the U.S. it earned the nickname the Tucker Turret.
Mm-hmm.
The, one interesting thing, right? Some listeners might be confused if you guys are hearing us talk about the Dutch government, then the U.S. government. What had happened was, in the 1940s, Germany invaded Holland.
Yeah.
And, Tucker wasn't able to complete the deal with the Dutch government, but he'd already kind of had a sunk cost here because he was partway through completing the prototypes. So he completed the prototypes and then he tried to sell them to Uncle Sam, and the U.S. government said, well, we already have some stuff we wanted to contract out, and this is way too fast for us.
Yeah, we're kind of liking that Jeep design. And, it's too fast. And besides that, you know, our specs are that, you know, a vehicle like this should really only travel at 35 miles per hour. That was kind of their maximum speed that they wanted these things to travel. He's got one that's going 115 miles per hour. And, you know, it's fully armored. It's an amazing vehicle, really.
Yeah, I would drive one.
I mean, the Jeep is cool. Don't get me wrong. I've always loved the Jeep vehicle, especially the military versions, you know, early on. But, man, this Tucker Tiger, this combat car that he created with the gun turret was so awesome, Ben. I mean, the thing, and I'll tell you about the turret just so that, you know, we get this out of the way. The U.S. Navy, eventually decided that they liked the turret design, and that's the only part they kept out of the whole thing. But it was power operated. It could rotate 360 degrees completely around, up and down, any direction, with just the flick of a finger, I guess. You know, the switch was just such a simple thing to do. And you can watch film of this is working, and it's really, really fluid in motion.
Yes.
Very, very, advanced design, especially when you think about it. It's happening in the late 1930s.
And why can you see so much film footage of this invention, Scott?
Well, because it was used on PT boats, it was used on landing craft, it was used on the B-17 and B-29 bombers. And, it, you know, it's incredible. It had, the vehicle itself, I guess, if we want to go back to that, I mean, all the stuff that it had.
Right.
It had three machine guns, it had anti-aircraft gun, you know, that was part of that turret design. All this stuff could be operated from within the turret. And, God, the thing fired, Ben, over 2,800 rounds per minute. So it was a formidable foe on the battlefield, really.
Yeah.
Or it would have been.
Speed of a cheetah, bite of a tiger type deal.
Yeah.
But the, something interesting happened.
Well, something sad happened.
Yeah. Well, that is the case, Scott. Now at this point in the story, one of the most reasonable assumptions would be that Preston Tucker becomes a very wealthy man because of his patents on a turret design that's almost ubiquitous, you know. However, as we come to find, his patent rights were infringed on.
Mm-hmm.
One would even say stolen.
Some were given away.
Some were given away.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent years in court afterwards
mm-hmm.
trying to straighten the situation
yeah.
out. But as a result, he did not see a lot of the money that
he,
came from that.
He got design. A little bit back in royalties, but not a whole lot. Nothing like what was probably coming to him. Now,
right.
the wartime effort is a little tricky because, you know, at the time, everybody's going for this one common cause. And when I say given away, you know, he had leased these patent or these designs to the military to you know, these companies to build the turret.
Right.
And then it was like, well, we modified that and that's no longer your design.
So now it's ours.
Yeah,
we tweaked it.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing that happened along the way. So in a way, you know, I guess in a way he got the shaft on that. In a way, you know, he's still known for it. It's still called the Tucker Turret. And he got his name put on this thing. He puts his name on everything, really.
Right.
It's always the Tucker something, you know, whenever he designs it, which is pretty smart, I think, right?
Yeah.
Any corporation that he formed seemed to have the name Tucker in it. It wasn't just some, you know.
Some just vague word like Horizons.
Yeah, yeah. Something like that that, you know, had no name associated with it. It's always associated with Tucker. And we'll find that, you know, as he goes from the turret design into, he gets kind of interested in aviation. In the early 1940s.
Yes, yes.
And this is just as the war is beginning to break here in the United States. So around 1941, 1943, something like that, he forms the Tucker Aviation Corporation.
Right. And as he always seems to do, Tucker starts this concern in his shed or barn, behind his house. And, you know, this is interesting because this reminds me of something that happens nowadays. It's super easy for people to start a company that
mm-hmm.
sounds legit, cause they have a cool address or they have, you know, stocks or whatever. The appearance on paper, may not match the appearance of the shed in someone's backyard. Point being, he issues stock for this thing. It goes public and it's just to raise enough money to design a fighter aircraft.
Yeah, aircraft and marine engines, I think, were some of the other things.
Yeah.
Now, the big thing you're talking about is the aircraft, the fighter, right?
Right, the XP-57.
Sure, and that was a fighter aircraft that never really saw the light of day.
Nope.
That was one that he had designed, and the United States Army and well, the Air Corporation was invested in something like this. They said, you know, we like this design, let's go ahead and do it. And he started to build it, and I don't know what happened eventually, but it just didn't work out.
Right. The U.S. Army Air Corps originally was in talks with him there, but the design got delayed because Tucker had some financial problems on his end,
mm-hmm.
and they let they being the USAAC, let the contract lapse and didn't renew it. Because he was running late there, no actual aircraft was ever built.
Sure. Well, if you look up XP-57, that's one way that you can find it. If you want to see a photo of this thing.
Like a prototype.
Yeah, prototype of this thing if you want to. Now, I think it's called the Tucker XP-57.
Oh,
again,
yeah, you're right.
Again,
excuse me.
He put his name on everything,
the
like
Tucker
I mentioned.
XP-57.
But it was powered by a straight eight, which was similar to a Harry Miller design, which it perfectly makes sense. I mean,
right.
Why not put a race car engine in your fighter jet, right? Or fighter plane aircraft. And it was nicknamed the Pea Shooter. So if you want to see a photo of it, you might be able to do a search for a pea shooter fighter craft or whatever, you know, and if you don't want to search Tucker XP-57, you want to be bothered with that, I guess. You could, you could search, you know, Tucker pea shooter and then
you
come
have time
up.
For dashes.
Now, during World War II, Tucker also met up with another guy. He's always meeting up with people, Ben.
Oh, I think I know who you're talking about.
Who's that?
Is that Andrew Jackson Higgins?
That is, yes. And he was the builder of PT boats and landing craft.
Yeah, and he is one of the people who also called Tucker the world's greatest salesman.
And the reason that they met up was because of that Tucker turret. Because remember, that's being used on these vehicles in particular, the PT boats, the landing craft, the bombers that we mentioned. So, you know, it's natural that he would meet up with Andrew Higgins. And, Higgins bought Tucker Aviation Corporation in 1942, and maybe that's where the XP-57 kind of fell apart. Maybe when this conglomeration happened, because in 1942, again, Higgins buys the Tucker Aviation Corporation, and now it's called the Higgins Tucker Aviation, or it's just called Higgins Tucker Aviation.
And Tucker is officially vice president of Higgins Industries,
mm-hmm.
and he's in charge of this Higgins Tucker Aviation. So what Higgins did essentially was help the company out financially and
mm-hmm.
own it and then keep Tucker in charge of it.
Yeah. And you know what? I think there's a gap in my notes here because I'm not sure where all this is happening, but it's not happening in Michigan. And if it is, it's happening somewhere else besides Ypsilanti because...
Well, he was in Louisiana.
Ah, Louisiana. Okay. So he had, again, he had moved his family down to Louisiana.
They had just started unpacking.
Yeah. In Ypsilanti, and they moved from Ypsilanti to Louisiana. And they're doing all this, you know, with the Tucker Aviation Corporation and then the Higgins Tucker Aviation. And then let's see, Higgins, in 1943, Higgins and Tucker, they find out that this relationship just really isn't working out. I guess, Preston, is more the one who says, you know, I just don't think that I'm really liking the way this is going.
Yeah.
I'm going to bail on this corporation and decides that I'm going to sever, you know, my ties with this corporation. And I'm going to move back to Michigan. So he's again, picking up his family and moving back to Michigan.
Yep.
And he's going to start his own automobile company called the Tucker Corporation. And that, I think, is maybe where we need to wrap up for today.
Yes, sir. This is going to end the first part of our podcast on Preston Tucker.
Yeah, you know, Ben, this is funny. We've gone all this way, and we still haven't even gotten to the part where most people thought we might begin with, right? Because, you know, when you think about Preston Tucker, you think of the Tucker 48, the Tucker Torpedo, you know, the car that that made the man famous, really.
Yep.
But there's so much more. I mean, we've just talked for 50 minutes, or, you know, or close to an hour, about Preston Tucker's life prior to that automobile, and that really isn't touched on a whole lot, even in that movie.
Yeah, I hope that what we're doing is finding some interesting and new stuff for fans of Preston Tucker that might inform it. But in the second podcast, oh, we're diving right into the cars. On our way out, Scott, could I trouble you for some listener mail?
Absolutely.
Okay, Scott, Jeffrey L. writes to us and says, I really enjoyed your MR2 podcast. Imagine you had a hard time figuring out what to include and what you had to leave out because of time, but I was surprised that you didn't mention several things non-fanatics found notable about them. Okay, and first was that the engine had four valves per cylinder, not unheard of, but still unusual at the time for general production car. Visually, the engine resembled an earlier Lotus Vision engine, as you pointed out. Fortunately, engineers redesigned the valve cover that perennially leaked in the Lotus, where leaking oil could immediately be ignited by the hot exhaust manifold. And I'm going to skip ahead just a little bit because here's one that I should have mentioned.
What's that?
The bane of MR2 owners, says Jeffrey, on the repair side was the cooling system. Having the engine in the middle but the radiator in the front of the Airstream meant that the coolant went to and from the radiator by first going down below the floorboards. I remember my buddy Nathan, I remember his cooling system breaking fairly frequently.
I read, you know, just a paragraph about this somewhere along the way when we were doing all of our research for this. You know, we had a huge amount of notes for that one as well. That was another two-parter,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was.
And I read a paragraph about that. And I didn't put anything in about it because I thought, well, you know, how many people are really going to be able to relate to something like this? But, you know, I guess we should have just to clear that up. But, yeah, I guess that would be really particularly troublesome, right? I think he mentioned bleeding the system, right?
Right, yeah. He says the design resulted in immense difficulty burping air out after a cooling system repair. The engineers really hadn't provided enough air bleed openings to accomplish it easily.
Yeah, that's understandable. And I think he mentioned that, you know, some of the crazy things that he's seen along the way are you'd have to prop up, you know, the car in these unbelievable angles in order to get the air bubbles out.
Yeah.
And dangerous angles. Like people trying unique things that are definitely not in the service manual, you know, in order to get the air out of the system. But, man, that would be a tricky one, really. I mean, I don't know how you'd even do that. I guess a pressurized system would be the way to do it. But, you know, without any kind of factory backing or factory machinery to do that, that's really tough to do in your own garage.
Yeah. On the last thing you wanted to note, and this is one for our hardcore MR2 fans, on the possibly over-esoteric side, says Jeffrey, though Toyota has been known for having timing belt engines that are non-interference, that is, engines that are not destroyed internally if a timing belt breaks, the MR2 4AGXX engines were an exception to that. This is in spite of the fact that one can still see websites nowadays that erroneously list it as non-interference. So that's one interesting point that I think we should also mention. Jeff out there in Oakland, thank you for writing to us. We hope you enjoy the Preston Tucker show as much as you enjoyed the MR2 podcast.
Yeah, and I hope we're not leaving out too many things because, again, pile of notes and just facts and figures and information just keeps coming up on this guy. So, you know, we're trying to get everything in we can. We did the same for the MR2 podcast.
Uh-huh.
Invariably, we're going to miss a few things here and there. But I think we got the bulk of the story through, right?
Yes. Well, the only way to tell if we accomplished that is to go to the second part of our episode. Now, guys, please stay tuned. And if you want to hear about the Tucker 48, check in with us in our next show. In the meanwhile, feel free to hit us up on Facebook, hit us up on Twitter. You can drop us a line at carstuffshow.com. You can send us an email directly. Our address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.